The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Janet Haas. I'm a board member of the Free Library Foundation. I'm also chair of William Penn Foundation. And I am delighted to be here. To tell you the truth, I'm tickled pink. This evening's event is part of the Free Library's Leading Voices series, in which we feature great conversations with top minds in business. These important and thoughtful programs inspire us to become better leaders in the workplace and better people in our daily lives. Please join me and the donors listed in your program to support library programs that serve our communities. For example, Read by Fourth, After School and English as a Second Language programs, Prison Services, Business Entrepreneurship, and the Culinary Literacy Center. This work impacts the lives of many in our city and surrounding communities. Visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce transformative programming. And while you're at it, don't forget to sign up for a library card. It's now my greatest pleasure to introduce nonfiction author Daniel Pink. I love his books, and I imagine that most of you do as well. His six bestsellers, I only brought two here, but there's also Drive and Tonight's Book, but these are books I've read, are about business, work, and behavior. They map the modern career landscape, and they shed light on human motivation, the art and science of sales, and other complex, relevant, and very interesting topics. Mr. Pink appears frequently on NPR's Hidden Brain and the PBS NewsHour. He has served as co-host and co-executive producer of National Geographic's Crowd Control, a television series about human behavior. A business columnist for the Sunday Telegraph, he's been a contributing editor at Fast Company and Wired. The London-based organization Thinkers 50 consistently names him one of the top 15 business thinkers in the world. And his TED Talk on the science of motivation is one of the 10 most watched TED Talks of all times. His intriguing new book, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, details scientific keys to good timing in life, at work, at school, and at home. It has been lauded as deeply researched and wonderfully accessible. Forbes says, Pink has a knack for teaching in such an entertaining way that you'll forget that you are learning. We will witness this in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Daniel Pink to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Good evening. Thank you. Thank you, Janet, for that nice introduction. Thanks to all of you for being here. I'm always pumped when I'm at a library because I was talking to some people earlier before I came up here. The libraries played a huge, huge role in my life as a kid. I would not be a writer if it weren't for libraries. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio in the 1970s. So Columbus, Ohio in the 1970s was an absolute hotbed of social rest. It was not a lot going on. But it also had, had and continues to have a really, really robust, one of the best library systems both in the smaller towns and in the city of Columbus in the United States. And just played such a huge role in my life. Turned me into a reader, turned me into a writer. So I'm always glad to be at libraries. I'm even one of those people who, it's going to sound like a joke, it's not a joke. One of the happiest days of my life was when it dawned on me, on my first book, that I had a Dewey Decimal Number. You laugh, 331.25. And you can look that up. All right, so I'm happy to tell you about this new book. The book is called When, Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. What I want to do here is tell you a little bit about why I wrote it, a little bit about how I wrote it, and then just give you a couple of ideas from the book, and then we'll take some questions. All right. So I wrote this book out of a mix of frustration and curiosity. I was frustrated because I was making all kinds of timing decisions, when decisions in my own life. When should I exercise? When should I do this kind of work? When should I do that kind of work? When should I start a project? When should I abandon a project? And I was making those decisions in a very sloppy way, really just guessing. And I said, there's got to be a better way to make these decisions. So I started looking around for guidance. And to my surprise, there was not guidance. I figured someone would have figured this out and, you know, offered me some ways to make these decisions better. And that got me curious because, as Janet mentioned, I like to write about social science, behavioral science. And I said, well, I wonder if there's any research on this issue, just out of curiosity. And I went in there, and that took me down a rabbit hole of 2 years of looking at research on this issue. And I think what's interesting about this research is that, and one reason that I think there wasn't that guidance out there, is that this research is splattered across literally dozens of disciplines. So some of it is in social psychology, comfortable with that, economics, comfortable with that, but some of it's in molecular biology, less comfortable with that. Endocrinology, really less comfortable with that. Anesthesiology, all kinds of other fields of medicine. It turns out there's a whole field called chronobiology, which is the study of our biological rhythms. It goes to cognitive science, it goes to linguistics, it goes to a whole array of different fields where these scholars who end up being very much kind of cabined in their own worlds don't talk to each other and don't realize that they're asking actually very, very similar questions. What's the effect of time of day on how we feel, how we behave, what we do, how we do it? What's the effect of beginnings on how we behave? What's the effect of midpoints on how we behave? What's the effect of endings on how we behave? How does the way we think about time shape our perceptions not only, but also shape our behavior? So why are people who speak languages with a hard distinction between present tense and future tense actually less likely to save for retirement than people who have a murkier border between the tenses of past and present? How do groups synchronize in time? A lot of the things we do as human beings, we want to do coordinating with other people. How are we able to do that thing? And so what I decided to do with the help of two very able research assistants was go into this incredible body of research and try to crack the code. And so the research is totally interesting and it answers a lot of questions, but the big thing that we understand from this research is the following, that we think that timing is an art, but it's really a science. That when we still continue to make our timing decisions based on intuition and guesswork, as I did, and we don't need to do that. There is this rich body of evidence, there's a science to it, and if we harvest this science, we can make better, smarter, sharper, shrewder decisions about when to do things. So I think the research is totally cool, totally interesting, and answers a whole array of questions. When should you exercise, early in the day or late? Very, very clear answer to that question. I mean, I don't intend to give it to you, but there's a very clear answer to that. Very clear answer to that question. Why should you never go into a hospital or schedule an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon? For reals, don't do this. We'll talk about this one. Why does beginning your career during a recession depress your wages 20 years later? That the effects of graduating in recession shows up in your wages 20 years later. A lot of research on how beginnings affect us. Why do both human beings and great apes experience a midlife dip? This idea of a midlife crisis, completely bogus. No evidence of that. It's a complete mythology. But there is a U-shaped curve of well-being where we have a slight dip in the middle. And it turns out, great apes have the same thing. And it turns out, you ask people to do certain kinds of work, they also dip in the middle. What's going on about midpoints? That sometimes brings us down, sometimes fires us up. I mentioned coordinating with others. Why is singing in a choir as good for your physical and mental health as exercise? This is amazing. Do we have any people who sing in a choir here? Okay, so you're gonna outlive the rest of us and be a lot happier while you're doing it. The research on choral singing is extraordinary. Choral singing, you think about the research on like exercise. It basically says, you really should exercise. There's not much of a downside. It's going to make your physiology, your psychology a lot better. Meditation, too. Research on meditation shows that's pretty darn good for you. I think that choral singing is actually, I think exercise gets the gold medal. I think choral singing gets the silver medal in terms of its benefits, physiologically even. Not only psychologically, but physiologically. People have elevated pain thresholds after choral singing. Their immune response increases after choral singing. It's extraordinary. We can talk maybe more about that in Q&A. And there are other kinds of questions, too, that this research answers. Questions that I hope are not on your mind, but if they are, it can answer. Like things like, when during the year is your spouse most likely to file for divorce? And it turns out there are two huge spikes in divorce filings. 2 months with huge spikes in divorce filings each year across the United States. So I could tell you, what I'm going to tell you is check your email for the next 18 days because March is one of them. But what I want to do now is I want to share with you two ideas from the book, and then we'll take some questions. The first idea comes from something that I learned. It might be self-evident, might have been already evident to you. It was novel to me, which is that a lot of the things, when we think about time, a lot of the things we think of as quote-unquote natural units of time are not natural at all. Like a second, that's not a thing. All right, a minute, that's not a thing either. It's something human beings invented. An hour, something human beings invented. A week, something human beings invented. They're just attempts of human beings to corral time. They're not really things. But there's an exception to that. A day is a thing. Okay? This is the sophisticated science I'm bringing to you on a Tuesday night. A day is a thing, right? Because we're on a planet, and that planet is turning, right? So I'm going to start talking about one aspect. I want to talk about the day. That's one idea on the day, and then I think it's an important idea, and then another one more on the episodic nature of our lives. So let's talk about the day. And what I want to do here on the day is I'm going to hit you with some science here. I want to give you, let me give you the point here. The hidden pattern of the day profoundly affects our mood and our performance. So I'm going to give you two studies on mood, two studies on performance, then we'll wrap it up, and I'm going to give you some things to do about it. Okay, so let's start with mood. One of the interesting things going out there in the world of research, and those of you in many, many fields understand this, is the ability of gargantuan data sets and have the tools to analyze them, which is giving us things that otherwise would have been invisible. One of the pieces of software that allows us to do this is something called the LIWC, pronounced Luke, the Linguistic Inventory Word Count. And what that is basically a giant, powerful text analyzer. So you can take any body of text, put it in here, and it can tell you really interesting things. So for instance, if we were to go into this library, let's say we had this, pick a novelist.
Steinbeck,
very good. So we take all the novels of John Steinbeck. All right, we take all the novels of John Steinbeck. Let's take the short stories, too. Novels and short stories of John Steinbeck. Put them into this program, and we can start asking questions. Okay, in Steinbeck's writing, how often are scenes set in the day? How often are they set at night? How often do women have speaking parts? Probably relatively rarely in Steinbeck novels, as I remember it. How often do women have speaking parts? How often do men have speaking parts? What is the weather like over the course of these? Is he talking about rain a lot? Is he talking about dryness a lot? How often does he use adverbs? How often does he use the passive tense? So all kinds of things to really get into the guts of this. And if you think about you have people who devote their whole careers to that kind of analysis, basically an entire lifetime to analyzing Steinbeck, and you can get some insights by just pressing a button, essentially. And so the point of all this is that this all allows us to have some clues about how we feel, how we behave, how we navigate life. And so this first piece of research here, I'm going to make one small change here. I realize I just screwed something up. One small change. Do not.
Fresh start.
There you go. Say hi to my kids. hang on a second here. So I've got this. There we go. See how much better that is? Thanks. you know what that was? What I had on was a program that actually limits the blue light that comes from a computer, and I have that go on automatically at night, so for wakefulness and all that. So it's actually inadvertently, conceptually linked to my topic here tonight. So anyway, back to this. So here's the text that these people use. So you're going to use two researchers at Cornell. They decide not to use Steinbeck novels, but they decide to use another body of text, which are tweets. 500 million tweets. Tweets are text, right? The computer is agnostic about where the text comes from. It could come from one of America's great novelists. It could come from 2.4 million people in 84 countries who are tweeting. So they put these, so that's a lot of tweets, 500 million tweets, none of them from the president. Put them into this program. One of the things this program can do is it can measure the emotional level of the words. Is this word conveying positive emotional sentiment, negative emotional sentiment? What's the emotional valence of these words? And so they put these things into this program, and they want to know, do people's moods, as evinced by their tweets, change over the course of a day? Are people have better moods at different times of day? And it turns out that they do. Take a look at this. What they found was, in the morning, a peak, a trough, and a recovery. Mood went up, then it went down, then it went back up again. A peak, a trough, and a recovery. A peak, a trough, and a recovery. Interesting. So put that on the shelf. Plop! Another piece of research, Daniel Kahneman, famous Nobelist, a psychologist who won a Nobel Prize in economics. He did some research on a different methodology, working with a fellow named Alan Krueger, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama. They did another piece of research where they asked people, write down the episodes of your day and tell us how you're feeling during each episode and what time it is. So you would say, I would say something like, well, what time is it right now? Like, I don't have a watch on her, which means we're going to be here for a while.
Eight.
So it's eight. Is it eight already?
7:55.
Okay, 7:50. All right, so anyway, so we'll just stipulate it 7:53, all right? So I would write, 7:53, I'm at the free library, my positive emotion is very, very high. I have to leave on Amtrak tonight, it's like, 11:30, I'm on an Amtrak through New Jersey, 4 out of 10 on positive mood. And so we're actually at a decent, if we are a little bit before 8, we're at a decent time. And if nothing else, you're going to feel a lot better when this is over. So Kahneman, Krueger et al. Decided to map the change in mood over the course of a day. And here's what they found. Here's their chart. What they found is a peak, a trough, and a recovery. Mood went up, then it sunk, then it recovered. Peak, trough, recovery. Now, these are not identical images, not identical shapes, but they rhyme, right? They rhyme. They have the same basic kind of underlying architecture. And what researchers in these fields have found over and over again is this pattern of mood over the course of a day for large populations. Up, down, up again. Up, down, up again. Okay? So we'll put that on the shelf. Plop. Let's talk about performance. Right? We know about mood. We know mood affects performance. We know performance affects mood. Those of you who are working want to know, hey, am I better at certain times of the day? Let's take a look at some of that research. Because I think it gets super interesting. So once again, we turn to our friend Big Data. Some researchers at NYU did just a remarkable piece of research, just remarkable. Using the same text analyzer program, except their body of text wasn't tweets, it wasn't Steinbeck novels, it was the transcripts of public companies' earnings calls. Each quarter, public companies do an earnings call where the CEO, the CFO, maybe a couple of other executives get on the phone basically with analysts and journalists. Here were our earnings this quarter. Here's what we expect for next quarter. Here are the bad things that happened to us. Here are the good things that happened to us. Here's guidance on how we're going to perform subsequently. And so these earnings calls for public companies are transcribed. That makes them text, right? Remember, this program is agnostic about where the text is coming from. They just want words. And so these researchers looked at 26,000 earnings calls, 2,100 companies, 6.5 years. This is the big data. And they actually started out looking for something else, but what they ended up finding, they ended up asking another curious question. Let's go back to positive and negative mood. Does the mood of these calls change based on what time of day it is? And the answer was, yeah, it does. Take a look. Afternoon calls were more negative, irritable, and combative, leading to this is the key thing here, temporary stock mispricings for firms hosting earnings calls later in the day. So thank you for the wow, whoever said wow over there. Thank you. Tell me your first name.
Madeline.
Madeline gave a wow, and that is a wow. Thank you, Madeline. Because if you think about this, I mean this very seriously. Just unpack this for a second. CEOs and CFOs of public companies, reasonably experienced people, right? More or less, right? But they're reasonably, I mean, they're not, you know, novices. You know, they're reasonably seasoned people. Those of you who work at public companies, do these CEOs, CFOs, other executives who do these earnings calls, do they prepare for these calls? Heck yeah! They prepare like crazy for these calls. They have talking points, they rehearse, they anticipate questions, they're very well prepared. Another question, do they have anything at stake in these calls? Yes, they do. So here you have these seasoned people, well prepared with something at stake, and they're leaking, right? The afternoon calls are more negative and irritable than the calls the other times of day, and what's happening is that this is true even if you control for the fundamentals. Even if you control, it's not like companies with bad news were doing their calls in the afternoon. Even if you control for fundamentals, the same thing happens. And what it ended up doing for a short period of time was mispricing the stock. The negative sentiment dropped down, lowered the price below what its natural price should be based on the fundamentals. And I'm convinced there is somebody out there sitting in a garage somewhere who has written a program to exploit that delta between the unnecessarily low temporary misprice and the true price. All right, and it's so extreme that these researchers actually did something researchers rarely do, is that they gave actual advice to people, which is, and they say, an important takeaway from our study for corporate executives is that communication with investors and probably other critical managerial decisions and negotiations should be conducted earlier in the day. Okay, so let's talk about one more aspect of this, and then we'll pay it off. Let's talk about education. And let's talk about standardized tests. And in particular, let's talk about standardized tests in Denmark. And the reason we're doing this is because what happened in Denmark is something that makes researchers weep with joy. I'll explain. In Denmark, students take standardized tests on computers rather than on pencil and paper, as some schools still do it here. The problem is that in the typical Danish school has more students and computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time. As a consequence, the students are randomly assigned, that's where the weeping begins, to take the test at different times a day. Some take it in the morning, some take it later in the day. So Francesca Gino at Harvard and two Danish researchers looked at 2 million test scores from Denmark. Does time of day matter in student test scores? The answer, you betcha. For every hour later in the day, scores decrease. We find that an hour later in the day causes a deterioration in test score that is equivalent to slightly lower household income, less parental education, and, here we go, missing 2 weeks of school. So, you got two kids taking standardized tests. This one scores here. But this one could be scoring here because she took the test in the afternoon. She's scoring as if she missed 2 weeks of school. So this is alarming. So we're going to make decisions about education policy based on standardized test scores when there's that big of a time of day effect? That's alarming. You know what's more alarming? Are we going to make decisions about this kid when if she had been randomly assigned to the morning, she might have scored higher? This is a little bit frightening, okay? But here's where it gets really frightening. Let's talk about healthcare. No, I'm going to talk about healthcare. You really, if you can avoid it, I'm serious. If you can avoid it, you should try to avoid going into a hospital willingly. I mean, if you get hit by a bus, go to the hospital. You know, it's not like, oh, you know, if I get hit by a bus, okay, I'm feeling terrible, but just let's wait till the morning when doctors are a little bit more vigilant. You want to avoid serious medical procedures if you can when they're in the afternoon. Case in point, anesthesia errors, 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. I didn't get a wow for that? Yeah, okay. Thank you. Let's talk about hand washing in hospitals. Hand washing in hospitals as the day proceeds, huge drop off in hand washing in hospitals in the afternoon, which leads to superbugs. You know what? You guys are out for, you know, you guys are generous people. You're out for an evening of supposed enlightenment, a little break from the ordinary. Let's talk about then colonoscopies, all right? Colonoscopies. Doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams for the same population. Over and over and over, you see this. So what we see over and over again is a pretty significant effect on our mood and our performance over the course of the day. What we know, there are three key points here in this research. It's a lot of really interesting stuff there, but what it distills to is this. One, and this is maybe the most important thing, and I'm a little bit irked that nobody told me this until I started. Our cognitive abilities don't remain static over the course of the day. They change, all right? That's not a weakness on your part. That's not some kind of moral flaw on your part. That's how our brains and our bodies work. Our cognitive abilities don't remain the same over the course of the day. Two, these daily fluctuations can be more extreme than we realize. So for instance, Russell Foster at Oxford says, the performance change between the daily high point and the daily low point can be equivalent to the effective performance of drinking the legal limit of alcohol. All right? Three, the best time to perform a task depends on the nature of the task. Different tasks are better at different times of day. And so this offers sort of the first kind of meta guidance for what to do about this. But for me, this was a revelation. Like, we're just not the same every time of day. Our brain power changes over the course of a day. It's not because you're weak. It's not because you're strong. It's because you're a human being, a biological creature, a temporal creature, living in a temporal world. What do you do about this? Here's where I think there's some good guidance on this. So let's explain this. Each of us has what's called a chronotype, which is our propensity to go to sleep early and wake up early, or go to sleep late and wake up late. Some of us are morning people, larks. Some of us are evening people, owls. Some of us are in the middle, what I call third birds. Owls represent about 20% of the population. Yeah, probably a few owls here. Yeah, okay. Owls represent about 20% of the population. Strong larks represent about 15% of the population. The rest of us are in the middle. Now, for the owls, I totally feel your pain, because I think the corporate world is explicitly designed to crush the spirit of people who are owls. Yeah, exactly. We got the emerging owl caucus here at the Philadelphia Free Library. So most of us move through the day in this pattern, peak, trough, recovery. We all experience a day in three rough stages, peak, trough, recovery, peak, trough, recovery. 80% of us go in that order. Owls are much more complicated on many different things. They tend to go in reverse order, recovery, trough, peak. As Steve was in the front row was saying, he's an owl. He said, we get going. He just said, yeah, you fight back when everyone else is asleep. You do your good work when other people are fading. So that's important. So it's important to know which type you are. It's relatively easy to figure out. We can talk about that perhaps in Q&A. But 80% of us move through the day peak trough recovery. So here's what we know. All right, here's a chart that lays it out. Okay, the science doesn't give us specific guidance. You should start doing your work at 7:41. And work till 9:13 and take a 9-minute break. It doesn't give us that granular kind of guidance, but it gives us some design principles. During our peak, the key about our peak is that during our peak, that's when we are most vigilant. Vigilance is the most important word here. During our peak, which for most of us is in the morning, for owls it's later in the day, evening, around this time. That's when we're most vigilant. What does it mean to be vigilant? Vigilant means you can bat away distractions. You don't get distracted very easily. You have these kinds of distractions that are trying to intrude on your concentration. You go, bat them away. All right? So during our peak, that's when we should be doing analytic work. That's work that requires heads down, focus, attention, and energy. Writing a report, analyzing data, going over the steps of a strategy, the stuff that requires vigilance and focus and analytic thinking. Next stage, trough. During your trough. That's not good for very much. It really isn't. That's when you should be doing your administrative work. And we have a lot of administrative work in all of our jobs. Answering routine email, filling out expense reports, that kind of stuff. We're better off doing that kind of work in the trough. During the recovery is actually a really interesting period. So what happens? The recovery, remember, our mood goes back up later in the day for most of us, but we're less vigilant. So let those two ideas coalesce here. Higher mood, less vigilance. That makes it a good time for certain kinds of creative and insight work, brainstorming. Things that don't require that tight analytic focus, that require a little bit more expansiveness, a little bit more looseness, what social psychologists call insight problems. And this is pretty much it. We should be doing our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during the trough, and our insight work during the recovery. It's as simple as that. Now, it's going to vary, again, the specific time of day of your peak and my peak and her peak and his peak is going to differ, obviously. But these are our design principles. Analytic in the peak, administrative in the trough, insight in the recovery. But here's the problem. We don't do that. And I'm a sinner here. I've been a sinner. I'm saved now, but I've been a sinner. So I'm a writer, all right? And I test. I'm in the middle, but I lean more toward Lark than Al. And I'm a writer. So writing is analytic work. It requires the worst thing for a writer are distractions. And so you want to be able to bat away distractions. So I should be doing my writing in the morning. But I've had many days where I come into my office I work in the garage behind my house. Come into my office. And I say, okay, I'm going to start writing. It's going to be a good writing day. I'm going to knock out some words. Let me answer a couple emails. So I answer two or three emails. Then it's 23 emails. It's like, well, by this time, there's something on Twitter. There's got to be. Let me just check that out. Just make sure I'm not missing anything. Clear the decks. You know, and then like five ESPN highlight reels later, it's lunchtime. And so then what happens? Then I go into the trough. And I try to do writing, and it's like riding a bicycle uphill against the wind. All right? That's bad, and I shouldn't be doing that. And I actually reconfigured my schedule, reconfigured how I do my work based on this. So this book, I wrote probably 90% of the words in this book before noon because I was much more intentional about when I was doing my work. The worst culprit, though, are organizations. Because organizations don't care about this at all. And if there's one rant that I have many rants, but sort of my rant of the moment is meetings. When organizations schedule meetings, they use only one criterion. What is that? Thank you, availability. That's it. We don't say, what kind of meeting is this? Do we need people to be heads down and focused and analytical? Is it a brainstorming meeting? What? Who's going to be there? Are there going to be morning people at this meeting? Are there going to be intermediate people in the meeting? Are there going to be nighttime people in this meeting? We just say availability. That's all we care about. Totally unintentional. It's treated with the strategic urgency of what kind of paper towels are in the company restroom. It's like, oh, this is not material to our performance. But it is. And so as a consequence, what you have is you have companies with people who do their best analytic work in the morning who get called into a 9:30 meeting about the travel voucher policy and ended up getting that squandered. Or you have a meeting of owls, and you say, come on, owls, come into this 8 o'clock meeting and let's laboriously go over all of these lines of code in our program and figure out what's going on. You know, and they're just like slapping their heads. They can't, you know, even see straight at that point. And so what do we do about all this? Well, first of all, we do this. We explain, the time of day effects explain about 20% of the variance in human performance on workplace tasks. Okay? It doesn't mean timing is everything. It means it's a big thing, though. What do we do about this? Some takeaways. One, we have to be much more deliberate and intentional in scheduling individual and teamwork. When people work matters as much as what people do and how we do it. How many of you today at work had a to-do list? Anybody have a to-do list? That's intentionality. That's intentionality about what you're doing. We're intentional about what we're doing. We're intentional about how we do it. We're intentional about who we do it with. But we're less intentional, far less intentional about when we do things. We think all times a day are created equal. It's a matter of convenience and logistics and availability. And that's wrong. Our cognitive abilities don't stay the same over the course of a day. It's a strategic decision at the individual level and at the organizational level. Two, basically, it's this simple. Move analytic tasks to the peak, administrative tasks to the trough, and insight tasks to the recovery. You do a little bit of rejiggering there, you're going to see a boost in performance, a boost in your well-being. And then finally, we need to take more breaks and we need to take better breaks. I have a whole chapter in the book about breaks. And my view is that the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, we considered people who would come into the office and say, I pulled an all-nighter, my second all-nighter this week. I haven't gotten more than 4 hours of sleep any night for the last 6 weeks. And I myself would look at that person as, wow, you're tough, you're committed, you're a serious player here. We think of that person as a hero. Then what happened? After 15 years, the science of sleep has deepened. It's gotten into the public consciousness. So now we look at that person today and say, well, you're not a hero, you're an idiot. You're hurting your performance, you're hurting other people's performance. And so I think breaks is where that is. We can talk more about breaks in the question. Let me do one more idea here. Move out from the idea of a day and talk about the episodic nature of our lives. We live our lives in episodes, as I mentioned. Beginnings have one effect, endpoints have another, midpoints have another effect, endings have yet another effect. I'm going to give you a taste of some of the research on endings, just because this is one of my favorite bodies of research here. There's so much cool stuff on how endings affect our behavior. I'm going to give you a little bit of a taste of it here. So let's talk about what endings do. They do a lot of things, but among the things endings help us do is they help us energize and they help us elevate. They help us energize and they help us elevate. So let's talk about marathons. Anybody here run a marathon? Well, lots of you, okay. So here's a question for you. At what age are people most likely to run their first marathon?
29.
45, okay. So the answer is, just think about that for a second. Somebody was either a very good guesser or had read the book. The answer is 29, all right? 29. So that's kind of a weird, are you serious? Okay, cool. So so tell me your first name.
Max.
Max ran us. Why'd you do it at 29, Max?
I was in graduate school and I had been dumped recently.
Okay. So this is the running as therapy lecture is down the hall. But that's good. No, that's good. So I'll show you something interesting. So I think that the age that you picked, if we look at large populations, it's actually quite interesting. What is it about 29? We can explain a little bit more of it in this chart. So 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a marathon as 28-year-olds. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a marathon as 30-year-olds. Whoa, that's interesting. Is there a massive physiological Janet's a physician. Is there a massive physiological difference between 28-year-olds and 29-year-olds? Between 29-year-olds and 30-year-olds? No, what's happening? You're reaching 30. You're coming to an end. You're coming to the end of something. Endings help us energize. Endings help us energize. This is the work of Adam Alter and at NYU, Hal Hirschfield at UCLA. So, okay, so here's another guess. Guess what other age, maybe roughly 10 years later, people are disproportionately likely to run their first marathon? 39. Okay, here's a harder one. Guess what's another age at which people are disproportionately likely to run their first marathon? 49, what a brilliant crowd here. And as luck would have it, I have that chart. 49-year-olds, three times more likely to run a first marathon than 50-year-olds. Endings help us energize. When we get to the end of something, we kick a little harder. It's a very sturdy principle of psychological science. Those of you who took psychology when I did probably had a fellow named Clark Hull on their midterm. Clark Hull came up with something called the goal gradient hypothesis, which basically says that the closer a rat got to the food, the faster the rat ran. And we see that a lot. Endings have a really interesting effect on getting us to energize, getting us to move a little faster, feeling a sense of urgency, just getting us to move. Let me give you one other example of that, and then we'll give you a couple more pieces on endings. Endings are so cool. So suppose that I were a far more generous person than I am. And I said, you know what? I love Philadelphia so much, I'm going to give everybody here a gift certificate. But I'm going to treat the gift certificate differently. So this half of the room, I'm going to give you a gift certificate, and it's going to expire in 3 weeks. This half of the room, I'm going to give you a gift certificate, but you have more time to use it. It expires in 2 months. Who's more likely to use the gift certificate when we come back 3 months later? You think? Okay, let's take a look. Let's take a look at the numbers. All right, give them 3 weeks to use this. Only 31% of people use the cash in the gift certificate. You give them 2 months, only 6% did. Now, take a step back and think about that for a second. This group over here had over twice as long. What's going on? They keep putting it off. They don't feel that sense of urgency. The end is salient here. It's less salient there. Endings help us energize. So much interesting stuff on that. Let's go to a couple more on endings, and then we'll take some questions. All right, so think about this famous phrase right here. I've got some good news and some bad news. I've got some good news and some bad news. Now, famous line, I wanted to know who said this. And so I went to the Google to do a little research, and I found who said it. Everybody. Everybody has said this. So here's a question for you, all right? This is a question. What should you give first? You're giving good news and bad news. Should you give the good news first or the bad news first? All right, here's what I do. I give the good news first. Why? It's uncomfortable giving bad news, right? So you want to ease into it. Why else? I feel like if I give somebody bad news straight out of the gate, they're going to shut down. They won't listen to the rest of it. Why else? I feel like just as a matter of human decency, you want to lay down a cushion before delivering the hammer. Okay? Now, let me ask you a different question. Okay? I'm not going to ask you what you should give first. I want to ask you a different question. I want you to put yourself in the seat of someone hearing this. Someone comes to you, a boss, a romantic partner, a teacher, whoever, physician, and they come to you and they say, I've got some good news and some bad news. Which do you want to hear first? Let's just see. How many people want to hear the good news first? How many people want to hear the bad news first? Look at that. That's overwhelming, right? That's what this Angela Legg and Kate Sweeney, 4 out of 5 people prefer to begin with a loss or negative outcome and ultimately aim with a gain or positive outcome rather than the reverse. And what we've done is we've started making these sort of sequential temporal decisions in a guesswork way rather than an evidence-based way. And what they say is that our findings suggest that doctors, teachers, and partners might do a poor job of giving good news and bad news because they forget for a moment how they want to hear news when they are patients, students, and spouses. What's going on here? Another principle of endings. Given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. We prefer rising sequences to declining sequences. This has a huge effect. The way things end is so monumentally important. And the research on this is overwhelming on basically every domain of our life. We will evaluate the moral quality of somebody's life based on how she behaved in her final year. Essentially discount everything that came to that and over-focus on that final year. If you look at, you can see this anecdotally on Yelp reviews. You look at Yelp reviews, just pull up Yelp reviews of a restaurant, and you'll see that Yelp reviews disproportionately talk about what happened at the end of the meal as a way to evaluate that restaurant. But given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. Let me give you one more study and then some takeaways, and we'll take some questions. So let's talk about, here in Pennsylvania, Hershey's Kisses. This study was done at the University of Michigan. And what they did is these researchers set up a table at the University of Michigan, and they said, we're going to have a taste test of Hershey's Kisses. They claimed, we're going to have a taste test of Hershey's Kisses made from local ingredients. And so they brought in students, and the students were coming by, and the students participated in this taste test. But each student was treated in one of two different ways. So one student, tell me your first name.
Donna.
So let's say Donna is coming into the Student Center at Michigan. I say, Donna, would you like to participate in a taste test of Hershey's Kisses? Donna says, absolutely, she says. And so, well, thank you, Donna. Here we go. So here's your Hershey's taste test. Here's a Hershey's Kiss. It's made with local ingredients. Here's your first candy. Taste it and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. Here's your next one. So you ended up getting 5, but you didn't know how many you're getting. Okay, so tell me your first name.
Bob.
Bob is treated differently. The Bob group is treated differently. Bob, would you like to participate in this Hershey's Kiss taste test?
Yes.
Bob says yes with less enthusiasm than Donna, but I'll still let him participate. All right. Bob, here's a candy. Please taste it and rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. Here's your next one. Listen carefully. Here's your last one. Does the fact that it's last change Bob's view? Let's take a look. So on this chart, the gray is the Donna group, all right? The yellow is the Bob group. So here, the first chocolate, that's not a statistically significant difference. Look at the fifth chocolate. Whoa, people love that last chocolate. They love it. They loved it more than any chocolate they had. They loved it more than any chocolate anybody had. It was the same chocolate. What's going on here? Given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. So what do we do about this? I love the ending stuff. There's so much other cool stuff about endings, but I want to get to some Q&A. What are some takeaways for you? One, shine a light on endings to energize yourself and others. People will kick a little harder when they see an ending. So this is why things like interim deadlines can sometimes be effective. Other kinds of markers of ending. They also trigger, in the case of the nines, many endings trigger a search for meaning. People feel a greater sense of urgency about meaning in particular. Two, always give the bad news first. Three, highlight the last chocolate. I mean that. I think this effect is so powerful that I want you to think about in your own life, how can you do that? You're making a presentation. You're giving your spouse a gift. You're whatever it is. Think about that. Think about that last chocolate effect. Be intentional about that last chocolate. And finally, use endings as meaning makers. Endings trigger a sense of meaning. And so you can use endings as meaning makers. So I interviewed a bunch of teachers who do these extraordinary things at the end of a school term, at the end of a year, basically to lock in the experience, to give. So this one teacher I talked to, he's an economics teacher at a high school outside of Chicago. For his seniors, he has them write a letter to themselves at the end of the year that he mails to them 5 years later. You have another teacher, a college teacher, takes her students out to a local pub, and they make toast to one another. Here's what I learned from you. Here's what you taught me. I mean, just think about that as a way to seal the ending. So use endings as meaning makers. Let me stop there, and let's take some questions.
I was wondering, since we just turned back the clock, we sprung forward.
Yeah.
And I'm still affected by it because I'm very tired today. How does that affect the one?
Yeah, great question. There's actually a substantial amount of research on this. It's not super, super definitive, but it basically shows, I mean, to oversimplify the research, spring ahead is bad for you, fall backward is good for you. And so one of the interesting things that I, throughout the book that I write about is the effects, especially of time of day, on judicial and juror decision making. And so there's a famous study showing that judges make more lenient parole decisions earlier in the day and immediately after breaks. There's other research showing that jurors, when they deliberate in the morning, make decisions rooted more in the facts, and when they make decisions in the afternoon, they're more likely to resort to racial stereotypes. So there's a famous study where they have two defendants, same set of facts. One is named Robert Garner, the other one's name is Roberto Garcia. When the jurors deliberate in the morning, they treat Garner and Garcia the same. When they deliberate in the afternoon, they're more likely to exonerate Garner and convict Garcia on the same set of facts. And to the point, there's actually a really nice paper about a year ago on how judges on the Monday after daylight savings time issue sentences that are something like 8% longer than the sentences they mete out on an ordinary Monday. Like, the worst time to be before a judge getting sentenced is yesterday. So nothing you can do about that now, folks. But I think what that tells us is, whoa. I mean, no one ever tells you that in law school. We have a sense of the justice. I mean, I think now we have a lot of questions about how fair the justice, not sort of intentionally biased the justice system is, but how much the justice system depends on decisions made by flawed human beings rather than perfect algorithms. And there's a great book by a guy here in Philly named Adam Benferrato called Unfair that writes about, how our notions, like the way that we assume the world to work in judicial systems, justice systems, is completely different from the way the world really works in behavioral science. So, in terms of people's memories, in terms of people's bias, et cetera, et cetera. So we had this gentleman over there. Yes.
First of all, thanks a lot.
Hey, sure. Thanks for coming.
I really appreciate, Dan, is the way you've married both theory to practice.
Thanks.
I just want to acknowledge the multidisciplinary approach which you've taken.
Thank you.
Some quick questions.
Yeah.
Question number one is, inferred, I do believe, in what you were stating, is there is some element of control.
Absolutely.
Right. So you were quite deliberate in discussing CEOs, CFOs, CIOs, CMOs, all of those folks' earnings calls. But for most of the people potentially here in this room, we don't exercise the necessary degree of control. And I've read all your materials and your books, and I've studied
Thank
it. It makes great sense. So my question is, what, as an externality, what, if any, control issues are relevant? Two, multi-generationally, how do you see boomers, Xers, Yers, Zers, and the folks coming after that? And also, how does that all tie into motivation? So pick all of them, some of the above, none of the above.
Okay, cool. Let me deal with B. On the generational thing, there's differences in people's chronobiology as they age. So little kids are very larky, early morning people, as any parent might remember or know. Little kids get up insanely early, start running around like crazy people from the get-go. And then around age 14 or so, people have a significant change in chronobiology where they move toward lateness, sometimes 2-3 hours. And then there's a gradual return to larkiness over time. Men return to larkiness more slowly. They're more alley in general. They return to larkiness more slowly. And so you have some age effects. To me, I am not a big believer in generational explanations for things. I'm very, very skeptical of generational explanations for things. I think what you're seeing is, not to make it more complicated than it is, I think what you're seeing with some generational differences is what's called a time of life effect rather than a cohort effect. It's not a matter of being part of Generation X. It's about 28-year-olds are always like this. I think anecdotally we see that too, because if you look at some of the writing, basically every incumbent generation since the beginning of human civilization thinks the generation rising behind it didn't work as hard, didn't pay their dues, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm skeptical of the generational side. Tell me your first name.
Steve.
I'm skeptical of the generational explanation, Steve. I'm not skeptical at all of the age differences. And so this is one reason why school start times for teenagers are way too early. But I think your first point is actually really, really important. Some of it does, I don't want to presume control, but it's easier if you have some control. So what if you don't have control? I think it's an absolutely urgent question. What if you don't have control? I think you can work the margins. And so how do you work the margins? Most people have at least limited discretion over certain kinds of things. So take the limited discretion and use it when you can. The other thing that you can do is you can, I think that this is a healthy conversation. I don't want to put all the onus on the shoulders of individuals. I think that thinking about this as an individual problem actually corners people in a way that they shouldn't be cornered. I think that this is something that bosses should be thinking about. The bosses have greater control. And so bosses have to understand that their team, when their team does stuff, has a material effect on how well their team does it. And I think what an individual can do, maybe with another individual or two individuals, is begin to start those conversations with bosses. To say, we need a little bit more discretion, a little bit more liberty over when we do work. Now, assuming, even that I think is a tall order. I think there are a couple of things people can do. Number one is, if you're at your non-optimal time, it's really important to take breaks. It's really important to be intentional about breaks. So those nurses, the decline in hand washing in hospitals and nurses, the way to get the hand washing back up, give them more breaks, give them especially social breaks, breaks with other people. The students in the schools, the Denmark students, their scores dropped. As if they'd missed 2 weeks of school, if they took a test in the afternoon, the way to get the test scores back up, give them 20 to 30 minutes to run around before they take the test. And so the extent to which individuals have any control over their breaks, and again, but I think it's a matter for judges, for bosses. The other thing is also just, you know, I think bosses need to take the lead on this, because what I want is I want the system to accommodate the people rather than always forcing the people to accommodate the system. However, recognizing that's an interim step, I think you can do things to accommodate the system. So let's say, are you a lark or an owl, Steve? Okay, for the sake of my hypothetical, I'm hearing that you're an owl. All right? So who are the owls in the audience here? Okay, wow, a lot of you. Okay, so Steve is raising hands. Okay, so all you owls, how do you feel about an 8 o'clock in the morning meeting? Hate it. Okay, good, good. This it's like an Eagles fan crowd here. We're about to have a fisticuffs. So 8 o'clock in the morning meeting for owls is terrible. But let's say, to Steve's point, which is, I think, an accurate depiction of many people, the ground truth of many people's lives at work, I don't have control. The boss says we have an 8 o'clock meeting. I got to go to this 8 o'clock meeting. I can't say, ooh, excuse me, I'm an owl. I don't want to go fly there at this time of day, you know? So what do you do? I think that the individual can make some common accommodation. So let's say you're an owl with an 8 o'clock meeting. Here's what I would recommend that you do. The night before, during your peak, your evening peak the night before, take a few minutes. Think about that meeting. Think about what you want to accomplish, what you want to say, what questions you want to ask, what arguments you want to make, and actually fashion a little checklist in the way that surgeons now have checklists. Make a checklist for yourself and bring it with you to the meeting so you don't have to draw on your foggy 8 o'clock in the morning head. The other thing that you should do for the 8 o'clock meeting, if you're an owl, go out and take a walk outside. Go out and take a walk outside for 5 minutes. Because we know that moving is a good break. We know that nature is a good break. Take a walk outside for 5 minutes before you go into that meeting. Don't just go straight from your office racing into the meeting. Take a five-minute break. Or, even better, we know what else boosts mood. Doing good deeds boosts mood. So buy somebody a cup of coffee. Bring somebody a cup of coffee unexpectedly. So be intentional about doing those things to restore some of your energy and attention. I do this too. As I said, I'm much more larky. Every once in a while, you have a call. You have to do something with people in other countries and different time zones away. Putting me on an 11 o'clock conference call is not a good idea. All right. But sometimes I can't avoid that because I have to talk to somebody there. So what I do is I do two things. I work in the garage behind my house. So what I will do is I will actually sort of sit outside and go over what I want to, even if it's freezing cold, go over what just for a few minutes what I want to say. I also find that talking to my wife before that, just about something else, like talking to my wife 99% of the time puts me in a good mood. And so it's like a mood elevator and that little outdoor time, and it's like I'm slightly better in that 11 o'clock call. What else? Oh my gosh. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Daniel, thanks for being here. So I'm an investor, and there's a lot of talk among investors about, is it too early for this company, or is it too late? Or there's a lot of anecdotes that it's great to start a company in a recession.
And yeah.
My theory is that's really good in 2020 hindsight, but it's much harder like in the moment. What do you think about that?
I generally agree with you about that. So, you know, there's another investor out there you know of, Chris, no doubt, Bill Gross, who has, he looked at his own portfolio of companies and found that the best predictor of when a company was going to succeed was timing rather than team. I think that degree of timing is, more like luck, circumstance, random occurrences. So when we think about timing, it's good. It's actually connected to Steve's question. Like when we think about timing, it can mean different things. Oh, what great timing! I didn't, I crossed the street before there was this horrible car accident, or I turned the corner before. That's just randomness. That's just circumstance. That's just luck. And that actually plays a big role in our lives. We're very uncomfortable dealing with that. We're very uncomfortable acknowledging how much randomness plays in our lives. And investors are also about that, because if it's all random, then why am I entrusting my money to you to invest? And so I don't think there's anything good on that. The one thing that you do see a little evidence of is sequentially is this idea of the first mover advantage not being an advantage. there's actually some research on this. So it's basically what was the predecessor of Facebook? MySpace. Oh, it's like MySpace. Yeah, that kind of thing. So you have you have sort of the first mover often doesn't do it, and it's so the good line on this is basically the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. You actually want to be the second mouse in the sequence. But beyond that, I think there's a lot of luck and fortune, and all of us in our lives, whether we're investors or other things, sometimes make the right decision at the wrong time.
Hello. You alluded to this earlier. How do you determine if you're a lark or an owl, and can you change it by willpower?
Okay, great. Thanks for your question. Tell me your first name.
Roberta.
Roberta?
Yes.
Roberta. Okay, so Roberta, actually give Roberta the mic back if you don't mind. So first of all, there are a couple ways. One is there's something called the Munich Chronotype Questionnaire, the MC, MCTQ. They have chronotype hyphenated, all right, with a capital T. They're German. Munich Chronotype Questionnaire. So you can go online and find that kind of assessment. But there's also a back of the envelope way that is very accurate. And if you don't mind, we can do it with you. We can figure that out for you right now.
Yay. Roberta.
Okay. All right, do it. That's the kind of enthusiasm. Bob, that's the kind of enthusiasm I want. All right. So, Roberta, so I want you to think about what chronobiologists call a free day. A free day. Those are days, that's a day when you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock.
Oh.
Okay? You don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. What time would you typically go to sleep on a free day? You don't have to wake up to an alarm clock.
So the night before. After midnight, 1 or 2.
Okay, good. Morning. So let's, yeah. I mean, just say, want to say 1?
1 in the morning.
Okay, so you go to sleep at 1 a.m. Now, on a free day, what time would you then typically wake up?
The first time I wake up is...
What time would you wake up and get out and get out of bed? You know.
Pushing noon.
Oh, that's a long time. Give me the...
Don't judge me.
All right.
Everybody's judging
give me,
me.
Come back here, Roberta. Come back here. So give me, just imagine a situation when you're not like massively jet lagged or apparently recovering from a bender of some kind. No, I don't mean like when you're catching up on sleep.
Okay,
I mean just sort of left to your own devices. You're on the fifth day of your vacation.
Oh,
all right? And so you've
okay.
caught up on your sleep. It's a okay. free day. Your body's sort of doing its own thing. So you go to sleep, still go to sleep at 1?
Yeah.
Great.
1.
And then what time would you wake up? Probably earlier than noon.
A little bit earlier than noon. I'll say 10.
Great. Okay, great. We'll call 10. That's actually quite interesting. Okay, so go to sleep at 1, wake up at 10. So what we're trying to figure out is your midpoint of sleep.
Mm.
And so your midpoint of sleep would be 5:30, right? And then there's a distribution, but you can basically the rule of thumb is if your midpoint is before 3:30 a.m., you're a lark. You ain't no lark, all right? If it's 5:30 or after, you're an owl.
Okay.
So you're an owl. Does that seem right to you? This
yeah,
idea that you're more yeah.
It makes
and
sense.
So that's and so as an owl, and again, 20% of us are owls, and there are some people out there who owls are much more complicated than the rest of us.
Thank you.
They really are, and there's some people. When you look at the distribution is not a bell curve distribution of chronotypes, because in part because they're 20% owls, but owls also have no joke in the statistical distribution. Owls have a very long tail, and it was not meant as a joke. And so there's some people who are just really extreme owls, and it's hard because the world doesn't accommodate that. So what you have to do, Roberta, is look for things like we were talking about with Steve about how can you operate in a lark world a little bit more effectively. How can you take better breaks? If you have a boss, maybe talk to your boss and say, actually, I do better when, you probably get going maybe at 4 or 5 and you're feeling good then when everybody else is leaving. Maybe you can rearrange some of your work to do it then. But knowing that about ourselves is really important. I'll just wrap up on that because I think Roberta's question actually is really, really important guidance for us, because what we need to do in general is we need to be much more curious and observant about our own behavior. We watch other people's behavior, but we don't really watch our own behavior very much. And we know, once you start looking at it, you're just like, whoa, my brain power is not the same over the course of a day. It's different. So make a note of that. Keep track of that. I do feel better when I take a break, especially this kind of break. Pay attention to that. Do something about that. And so I think when you look at the science, it really distills into good news and bad news. I'll give you the bad news first. The bad news is that we're still not, we still make a lot of these timing decisions in a thoughtless way, all right? It's not only that we're making it in an intuitive way or guessing, we're making it in a thoughtless way. When we schedule meetings, when we decide what to do at different times of the day, when we make a doctor's appointment, And so that's the bad news. We're still not thoughtful about it. The good news is that the solution is actually relatively simple. It's that you just need to, and it's a good lesson for other realms of our life, which is this, you just need to be, to Roberta's point, you need to be a better observer of yourself, but in general, you just need to be more intentional. You need to be more intentional. You can't just let yourself drift through life. You have to have greater intention. And when you have greater intention, you can do better work. And you can feel a little bit better. And if you bring these questions of when and give them equal weight, not more, to who, what, and how, I really think that you can work better. You can get more done, you can be more creative, and you can feel a little bit better. Thank you for coming out on a March.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.